Welcome to TOL Talk. I'm Kai Krauthammer. This week marks 10 years since the end of Slobodan Milosevic's authoritarian rule in Serbia. After his resignation from the Yugoslav presidency, Milosevic was arrested and sent to stand trial for war crimes at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. The Milosevic trial is the subject of a book published this year, Twilight of Impunity, written by Judith Armata, an American lawyer and human rights advocate who monitored the Milosevic trial. Judith Armata's legal background and experiences in the former Yugoslavia inform her book. In the late 1990s, she worked for an initiative of the American Bar Association, helping legal professionals and NGOs to advance the rule of law in Serbia and later in Montenegro. And during the Kosovo conflict, she headed a war crimes documentation project among Kosovar Albanian refugees in Macedonia. Armata argues that the Hague Tribunal helped bring the perpetrators of many horrific crimes to justice, criminals from all sides who fought in the Yugoslav wars between 1992 and 1999. However, Milosevic himself died before a verdict was reached, leaving many questions surrounding his role in mass killings and ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo unresolved. Judith Armata, welcome to TOL Talk.
Thanks, Kai. It's nice to be with you.
So can I start out by asking you how you got involved with working with lawyers and judges in Serbia during the Milosevic regime?
Well, I'd always wanted to live abroad, and I needed a change from the work that I had been doing for 20 years. When the ABA began its program to assist Eastern European states transitioning from communism to develop rule of law, I applied and they sent me to Serbia.
What was the atmosphere like at that time? Did you ever feel any sort of pressure or threat against yourself or your colleagues?
It was tense then, yes. Milosevic, still president.
This was around 97, I think?
Spring of 1997.
Uh-huh.
It was essentially a lawless society where nearly everyone had to break a law to survive. Enforcement was political. The people were getting fed up with Milosevic. His party lost in local elections throughout Serbia, so he canceled the results of the election. A few courageous judges on the Supreme Court ruled his action illegal, and the Lawyers Association of Yugoslavia invited the American Bar Association to come to Serbia to support development of an independent judges association and to assist their efforts to develop rule of law. So it was a tense time, and there were some very courageous people, but it was also a pretty exciting time in that we came just after 3 months of the citizens of Serbia being down in the square, down in the central square every day through winter to protest Milosevic's theft of the elections.
At that time, did you have any idea that you would end up spending a good chunk of your life sitting in a courtroom where Milosevic himself was on trial?
Well, no, I didn't foresee that. I think nobody foresaw that he actually was going to be arrested. And he did not think that he would ever be arrested. We had Radovan Karadzic, the president of the Bosnian Serbs, and Ratko Mladic, the general of the Bosnian Serb army, had both been indicted years before, and
yes,
Nothing had happened. So everybody thought he was pretty safe. And at the time, I everything was heating up there. The situation in Kosovo was becoming very intense. Killings increasing, people being displaced. All the first year during 1998, before the war actually, well, before NATO entered the war in 1999. So I could see that, you know, things were happening, and it was certainly getting my attention, even though I was there to work on very specific sorts of projects. And then when the Kosovo War did break out, of course, I went down to Macedonia and worked with refugees there. And that was certainly promoted a hope that Mr. Milosevic would be held accountable.
Yeah, what sort of things did you witness when you were working in Macedonia?
Well, a lot of masses of people who were being forced over the border. They were trudging into the camps, makeshift camps that were set up by the United Nations. You know, muddy. They didn't have good facilities. Everything happened so quickly. People had lost people. They didn't know if they were dead or alive. It just was extremely chaotic and pretty frightening to see that many people move in such a short period of time.
And yet, within a couple of years, Milosevic was in The Hague on trial. And, of course, he died of a heart attack after 4 years as the trial was winding down, but before a verdict could be reached. What for you is the biggest question unanswered from the unfinished trial?
Well, I think the biggest question for me is how the judges would have ruled on the genocide charges. There was, as in any criminal trial, there generally is the defendant usually offers a motion to acquit on the charges after the prosecution has presented it and rested its case. And the judges then, what they do is they look at the evidence that was presented and decide whether there are charges that the prosecution just no way could prove given the evidence that they presented, and they'll dismiss those charges. Well, in Milosevic's case, they didn't dismiss any of the counts, and that included the genocide charges. So that was an area that there was very curious how the court would have ultimately ruled on that. The evidence, the public evidence in the Milosevic trial wasn't clear on his involvement in the genocide. It looked like it.
And this was specifically, the genocide charges were specifically related to events in Bosnia, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Not only Srebrenica, but also several other sites where genocide was alleged to have taken place.
That's correct. And those, in 1992, when the Bosnian Serbs had a surge, ethnic cleansing surge throughout northeastern Bosnia, those were the areas where people were killed en masse, village after town after town. And that's what the prosecution charged him with, genocide for those. And it was, the court looked at that and said that there was at least enough evidence to go forward. So that was a real question for me that I would have liked to have had answered, and I worry that won't be answered. Was that considered genocide? Was the genocide broader than Srebrenica? I think it's a pretty significant thing for how you look at that war.
You write in your book that may have been the prosecution's most difficult task, trying to build their case for genocide. And you also discuss, well, for instance, Milosevic throughout the trial accused the tribunal and Western countries of engaging in a vendetta against him and against the Serbian nation. And is there a kind of paradox in that here was one man who was on trial, and the trial had to focus on whether this one individual did or did not commit certain things, and yet because he had been the head of state at the time, and if genocide occurred, it can only have been through a chain of command and through the actions of many people, so that in a sense, the trial was also the trial of a system of which Milosevic was the head. Would you agree with that?
You know, in some ways it was, even though legally it wouldn't be characterized that way. Every attempt is made to show that it's an individual who's on trial. But he was charged with being a member of a joint criminal enterprise.
Can you briefly describe what a joint criminal enterprise means?
It's very similar to conspiracy. What it means is that some folks sat down and made a criminal plan. They had a goal, and the only way they could get to their goal was by criminal means, by breaking the law. And so that enterprise can involve a large number of people. And there certainly were other trials in The Hague where more than one person went to trial. You know, they tried the same person.
Yes.
Maybe they tried six people, those sorts of things. So you could see a little bit more how joint criminal enterprise worked there. But it was one of the things that Milosevic was charged with. And certainly Karadzic and Mladic are also involved in that. But I think your point is also important, and it's important to distinguish when you're talking about a system from the Serbian nation, that the tribunal is there to charge individuals so that the cycle of revenge doesn't continue. All Serbs were not responsible for what Milosevic did. In fact, there were a number who protested at great risk to themselves, and there were young men who resisted conscription and those who deserted the armies. you know, that's important to remember. But what you say is really true. You can't commit those crimes alone. And genocide in particular, requires a vast number of people to carry that out.
At the moment, Karadzic, his trial is underway, and although the prosecutors are now warning that it may drag on for 3 or 4 or 5 more years, what have the prosecutors and the judges learned from the Milosevic case as to how they can perhaps speed up the Karadzic trial and make it less of a sort of media feeding frenzy and more of a more legally based process?
Well, I'm pleased to see that they have learned some things. The first one is that the prosecution charged Karadzic with 11 counts, and Milosevic was charged with 66. So there's been some paring down of the actual indictment. It's easier to manage. Will be easier for the court to fit the evidence into the charges and that sort of thing. The other really important piece is Karadzic, like Milosevic, insists on representing himself. And that was very difficult in the Milosevic trial. And as you say, it did contribute to the length and also the trial as sort of a circus. In this case, what the court did is when they had the first day of trial, Karadzic didn't appear. When they had this second day, he didn't appear. And the third day, he didn't appear. So the court said, okay, you know, he's not cooperating. We will appoint counsel. And essentially what they did is appoint standby counsel. And that means somebody who sits through the entire trial. And then if Karadzic continues to be to inhibit what's going on in the trial, that they can take over. It has to be pretty serious, like Milosevic did, you know, days of inactivity and refusing to come to the trial. And also, I think in this case, they can also watch just how he presents his case and keep a tighter rein on that. And if he's abusive to witnesses or that sort of thing, that all that goes into the assessment.
Assuming the tribunal ever does finish its work, it seems to be being postponed endlessly. And of course, if Mladic is ever arrested, that could be another very long trial. But when it's all wrapped up, what do you think the main lessons to be learned from the Hague Tribunal are? Will it be seen as overall a success?
Well, you know, I think that by thoughtful people it will, and it should be. One is the first war crimes tribunal since Nuremberg and Tokyo, so there's a long gap in there. It did seek to hold and did hold leaders accountable, top leaders and people who were involved in the incredibly horrible war crimes and crimes against humanity that occurred down there. So anybody who's thinking about doing that or who's involved in that will hopefully think twice. They have to think twice because not only is there the ICTY, but then, of course, there were the other ad hoc tribunals like for Rwanda and Sierra Leone. And now we have a permanent international criminal court. So the game has changed. And I think that the ICTY was a necessary step in that process. I don't think we would have had the Rwanda tribunal without it, or the other ad hocs, or the international criminal court. Obviously, as a first time since Nuremberg, first time event, it's not going to be perfect, and it's going to have many flaws. And it did, you know, it does. But those are things to really take a look at and change. And as we move forward, you can't have perfection in first time out.
And as you point out, beyond the controversy over the Milosevic trial, there were several dozen suspects were brought to trial, and many of them were convicted on extremely serious charges. And these were people from all sides in the war. Do you think that the tribunal has been fully impartial in seeking to try people from all the major combatants during the Yugoslav wars?
I think that it has. You know, that's always a very difficult question because what you end up having is people, like in the former Yugoslavia, if you're from Bosnia, you have a different view of that than if you're from Serbia. And part of the reason is that the Bosnian Serbs in Serbia had more responsibility. They have to at some point face that they had more responsibility for the war crimes and the genocide. You know, and that doesn't mean that everybody else was really white. Obviously, they weren't. So I think that the court's attempt to be unbiased and fair has looked at that and has brought others, you know, Bosniaks and Croatians and Kosovar Albanians also to justice. I think that it given everything, that it's done a good job of being unbiased.
Several commentators, including the former chief prosecutor Carla Del Ponte and also Florence Hartman, who was the spokesman for the tribunal, have written books and accused certain countries, especially the United States, of either of interfering with the tribunal or of refusing to turn over valuable information, or even of not wanting to see Milosevic put on trial at all. What do you make of those sorts of allegations?
Well, one thing to start out with is that the United States, like other states, hasn't had a consistent policy towards the Balkans or the ICTY. It's changed when politicians have changed, and it's changed when political national interest has changed. So the United States, I think everybody started out with the view that the tribunal was really only going to be there for as a kind of a cover for the states that didn't want otherwise to intervene in the Balkans and to stop the wars that were going on. I think as the U.S. administration changed, there was more support for the tribunal. Now, with Milosevic, they went through there's this continuing tension between sovereignty and justice. And sovereignty says that a state can do whatever they want to, and there's no outside interference. But we have the Geneva Conventions and the Genocide Conventions and the Torture Conventions, and all of those things are a rein on sovereignty. Sovereignty is no longer absolute. So, you know, with that in mind, there were, like, trying to find a solution to the Bosnian War. Well, were there deals made with Milosevic, with Karadzic? What happened there? Possibly there were some deals made. Certainly there was an effort to continue to use Milosevic as the diplomat, as the person who controlled the Bosnian Serbs. And I think that kind of changed for the United States in 1999, or maybe 1998, when Milosevic was no longer useful as a diplomat. He was obviously out there creating havoc.
And this was at the time when Serbia was stepping up the pressure in Kosovo.
So he became a destabilizing factor. And I have to say, the United States was the one that, once Milosevic was arrested, they put pressure on Prime Minister Dinkić to send him to The Hague, and they did. I don't know that without that U.S. pressure they would have done that. The United States has also worked and pressed some of the European countries to say, don't let Serbia, join the EU, get the goodies and stuff until it complies with its obligations to turn over the accused to the ICTY.
You just mentioned Zoran Dzinjic. During the time of the Milosevic trial, Dzinjic was assassinated, probably by elements linked to extreme nationalist groups in Serbia. And also, many people suspect that elements in the Serbian military or security forces have been helping Ratko Mladic to evade arrest for all these years. Do you think that the Milosevic trial made it more difficult for reformers in Serbia? And, has Serbia gotten over its bad feelings against those who brought Milosevic to trial, and in your view?
Well, I think that it's very hard for Serbia. They were so heavily propagandized that it becomes, there's the extreme nationalists. They're kind of a lost cause. But then there's a larger segment of Serbs who, followed the Milosevic trial somewhat and, didn't feel that it was fair, I think, from their viewpoint. But those people were heavily propagandized, and they didn't have the kind of courageous leadership, I think, that would have helped them face Serbia's role in that and Milosevic's role in that. You know, that takes a while anyway, I think. But I don't know. I think you know, it is an analogy, really, but looking back to World War II in Germany and how people there needed to sort of look at what had been done in their name, that took more than a generation. So, you know, things are going to be stirred up in Serbia for quite a while, and I don't think they're going to be very fond of the United States and, you know, not to have very good feelings about the tribunal, largely. And I think that politicians will respond to that.
More recently, there's been a very fierce debate in Serbia about joining the EU and potentially even joining NATO. Most research suggests that a majority of Serbs are in favor of joining the EU. There is still a strong minority that says that because of what they see as the West siding with Kosovo in its bid for independence, that issue must be somehow resolved before Serbia can join the EU. Do you think that EU membership is feasible for Serbia, and do you think that would help it get over the traumas of the 1990s?
I definitely think that's possible. You know, there's a younger generation coming up. You know, the issue of Kosovo doesn't resonate with them the way it does with some of the older people and with, you know, more of a hardline nationalist group. And there is the plural majority wanting to go with the EU. It represents modernization. It represents... And the other thing I've said about Serbia is, you know, Serbia always considers itself part of Europe. Mm-hmm. And to kind of be excluded from that, I think, is really distressing for a lot of Serbs. So I think that there's real impetus there for them to join the EU and become where they get back where they belong.
All right. Well, Judith Armada, thank you very much for talking with us today. And good luck with your book, Twilight of Impunity.
Thank you so much, Kai.
You can read more about the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal and post-war Serbia at Transitions Online, www.tol.org. You can also follow us at facebook.com/transitionsonline. I'm Kai Krauthammer for TOL Talk. Thanks for listening.